From KMXT and Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
Researchers from the University of Alaska Fairbanks published a study last month looking at how ocean acidification affects Pacific razor clam development. KBBI's Jamie Deep has more on understanding the impact of changing oceans on the beloved mollusks.
Harvesting razor clams is a beloved activity for many Alaskan families, especially in Cook Inlet. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game manages a fishery for the clams in the Nanochik area, but it closed in 2015 due to declining populations. The fishery opened back up last year, but officials say it's unlikely to reopen for the foreseeable future. Marina Alcantar is a PhD candidate at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She says after talks with professors, they realized how little razor clams have been studied.
As we moved forward, it became kind of shocking how much we didn't know about razor clams, especially considering how much they're loved, especially in Alaska. And so it just really became kind of a mission to figure out some of their quirks and how they will respond under future ocean acidification conditions.
Alcantar collected clams from Western Cook Inlet and transported them to the Aleutic Pride Marine Institute in Seward for the study. She and other researchers looked into the effect of ocean acidification on the early development of razor clams in Cook Inlet. The study looked at the effect of high levels of ocean acidification as well as changing levels of acidification. The higher levels of acidification simulate what future ocean conditions may look like. However, in many parts of the ocean, the level of acidification goes through a cycle of changes. These changing levels cannot be replicated in a lab. Amanda Kelly is an associate professor at UAF. They say this varying acidification better reflects the clams' living conditions in Cook Inlet.
We know that razor clams inhabit the upper subtidal regions of the nearshore environment. And in Alaska, it happens to be super variable.
The study found that the acidification affects how the clam forms its shell. Razor clam shells are made of calcium carbonate, which is also found in chalk and limestone. The study used two different systems to analyze the mineral structure in the shells. Alcantar says clams in high and changing acid levels have a different structure than the control group.
And when we combined that data, it really pointed out to us that we are using some of the rarer and more vulnerable to dissolving versions of calcium carbonate.
She says as the shell forms in more and variable acidic conditions, they're more likely to dissolve. In addition to the results of the study, Kelly says doing this research gives a better understanding of basic information about the clams.
We really knew nothing about the early life history of razor clams until this study was carried out.
Alcantar says this information will help to regulate and protect future populations, but this is just the beginning.
It just means a lot, and I feel like, you know, it's a way for me to use my nerdiness for marine biology to serve my community.
Alcantar says she's waiting to publish another paper diving deeper into razor clams and may look into developing ways to grow razor clams in hatcheries. In Homer, I'm Jamie Deep.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, is a centuries-old concern for subsistence shellfish harvesters in coastal Alaska. It occurs when an algae species called Alexandrium blooms in the ocean, releasing lethal neurotoxins that end up lodged in many species of clams, mussels, scallops, and other shellfish. In high enough concentrations, a single clam could kill a person. But shellfish aren't the only targets of these deadly toxins. Scientists are beginning to explore how paralytic shellfish toxins are showing up across Alaska's marine ecosystem, from plankton to whales. Bruce Wright is senior scientist at the Kinnick Tribe and leads PSP monitoring efforts across the state.
One of the pathways is shellfish. They feed directly on the organisms. But the other pathway is Alexandrium to zooplankton, to macrozooplankton and forage fish, to predatory fish like salmon and cod, and then the top predators like whales.
He says this research could potentially help explain recent population declines and die-offs in the Alaska marine ecosystem, like the Pacific cod crash in the Gulf of Alaska or the 2020 collapse of the Chinook salmon fishery.
They had a big sockeye fishery and a pretty good-sized king salmon fishery, and it collapsed. So I went down there that same year and started collecting samples, and their PSP levels were high, and that was new for them.
Wright says the data his team has collected is anecdotal so far, but he's continuing to test samples from animals all over the state. He says he suspects toxins will show up in more places as climate change warms ocean waters and pushes harmful algal blooms further north. Steve Kibler, a NOAA research biologist who studies harmful algal blooms all over the country, says there are still a lot of unanswered questions, like how paralytic shellfish toxins move through the food web and what biological impacts they have on different animals.
You know, the way that they're getting there in each individual location where blooms occur, it can be a pretty complex thing to put together, especially when you just have a few data points to go on.
Kibler and Wright both have more data collection planned this summer to begin piecing together how paralytic shellfish toxins may be impacting the health of Alaska's ocean food web. And thank you to Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George for that reporting.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen, providing twice-weekly service to Alaska's Emerald Isle.
Alaska lawmakers heard overwhelming opposition on February 7th to a bill that would allow electronic monitoring in state fisheries. As KFSK's Hannah Flohr reports, most of the fishermen and industry representatives were concerned with the cost to fishermen.
Senate Bill 209 and its companion bill in the House would allow the state's Board of Fisheries to require electronic monitoring in state fisheries. The program would be managed by the State Department of Fish and Game. Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang told the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee the bill is meant to create another tool for fisheries enforcement.
I think the question comes down to right now the only tool that the board has when they're concerned about a fishery and the potential for some kind of violation occurring in that fishery is to put an observer on board the boat. They don't have any other option. So I think adding this tool to the toolbox gives the board another option.
The bills were introduced last month by Governor Mike Dunleavy. that would make it possible to use electronic monitoring in place of mandatory observers aboard fishing vessels. Currently, only a few state-managed fisheries require observers. Vincent Lang said that the small size of many fishing boats makes it difficult to find space for an observer.
Clearly, on a small boat, electronic monitoring would not inconvenience the boat operator by having to bunk that person and have them on the deck space while they're fishing. So like a seine boat, you know, there's limited bunk space and there's limited deck space when you're running the seine gear. That would be an opportunity not to inconvenience that boat owner with those kinds of presences on the deck.
And he said the price tag of electronic monitoring would be significantly cheaper than the cost of observers. Fishermen have to pay to have observers on their boats. They would also have to pay for the electronic monitoring equipment, which is estimated to cost roughly $17,000 to install, plus $5,000 in yearly maintenance. Senator Forrest Dunbar, an Anchorage Democrat, said that since very few state-managed fisheries require observers, it's inaccurate to compare the cost of observers to the cost of electronic monitoring.
It's not really we're reducing costs from observer to electronic. We're sort of going from nothing to electronic monitoring, which would be potentially a significant increase in cost for these boats.
Tracy Welch is the executive director of United Fishermen of Alaska. She told the committee the group opposes the Senate bill in part because of the expected cost to fishermen. She said she's concerned that many fishermen cannot afford those costs, especially given the current state of the seafood industry. And she says there's another problem. If electronic monitoring is mandatory, equipment failures could mean that fishermen would not be able to fish until the equipment is repaired.
I talked to one of my board members yesterday who is currently facing equipment issues for a cod fishery, and he is currently waiting for someone to come to his boat to fix it, and he cannot leave until that happens. So if this is really about enforcement, can we possibly put more money towards enforcement rather than electronic monitoring?
Charlotte Levy spoke for the Aleutians East Borough. She spent the last 6 years working with fishermen in the region to develop an electronic monitoring, or EM, program in the federal fisheries.
I can't stress enough that EM programs are very complicated. They are resource intensive and just as burdensome as observer programs and should be given the same rigorous setting prior to considering a new program.
She said that the federal electronic monitoring programs were based on existing observer programs.
The state currently does not have this level of infrastructure, and it's worth considering what types of resources and funding the state has to develop a new monitoring program where none currently exists.
All comments, both verbal and written, expressed opposition to the bill as it is currently written. Most were concerned with the potential cost of the program to fishermen. Some cited concerns with government overreach and surveillance. The Senate bill remains pending in the Labor and Commerce Committee. A similar bill in the Alaska House has not yet received a hearing. In Petersburg, I'm Hannah Flohr.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund. In recognition of the fishing industry, which provides more than 50,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source,